For decades, a mystery has haunted Tamworth.
Mark Anthony Haynes' body was discovered on an isolated stretch of train tracks.
No one talked about him. He was just another little black fella.
An ABC True Crime podcast was followed by a fresh inquest.
Everyone was just holding their breath.
If he didn't do it directly, he knows what happened.
With the truth closer than ever, hear the whole story now. Search for Unravel Blood on the Tracks. It's on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Katie Treble was the kind of kid who'd bring home orphaned baby rats and rescue trapped bugs and spiders. As a teenager, she wrote letters to dictators in faraway places, asking them nicely to please treat people better. Katie was always a big-time empath and idealist. So it makes sense that when she grew up and became a doctor, she felt like she should be using her skills where they were really needed. So Katie left her lovely life in Byron Bay to sign up for Médecins Sans Frontières, MSF, or Doctors Without Borders. And she was sent as far away as you can imagine from the good vibes and beautiful beaches of northern New South Wales. In the Central African Republic, in the middle of a civil war, Katie found out what it actually means to try and do good in the worst of situations. And she's written a memoir about her time as a humanitarian doctor. It's called Field Notes from Death's Door. Hi, Katie.
Hi, Sarah.
Australia's home for you now, but where did you grow up?
Well, technically I'm a Scouser originally. I was born in Liverpool, but we moved when I was about five to North Devon, very rural, you know, looks like Hobbit land. It looks like rolling green hills. There's beautiful beaches. There's a lovely coastline at the top. There's lots of trees, lots of forests. It's, pretty idyllic.
What sort of things did your dad construct in the back garden at your place?
Dad's a carpenter. That's his primary vocation. His other vocation is he's a orthopaedic surgeon, which are sort of the same thing in a lot of ways. He just loves building stuff. He showed me the first thing he ever built in his life out of wood. I think he was probably about 10 years old when he made it. It's a wooden box called Nick's Box, spelled N-I-C-K-S-B-O-C-K-S. It was written on the top. Yeah, just loves wood, loves carpentry, loves angles, loves putting things together. So when we were kids, he had this lovely cabin that he'd built with, you know, cedar shingles on it. And he built a big, it was more of a tree deck than a tree house, this massive, massive tree house that was there. And many constructions. We lived on the side of a very steep hill, and he built a big platform that caught the final bit of sun at the end of the day. And he used to call it his erection, which was it's like, shut up, Dad.
Come and see the sunshine from my erection. Thanks, Dad.
Yep.
How did you get an insight into the other kind of carpentry that he performed as an orthopaedic surgeon?
I was the oldest daughter and oldest kid. You know, Dad would go off to work and I would say, Dad, what are you doing at work? What's happening? And he would tell me about all these amazing things that he was doing, which is, you know, knee replacements and hip replacements. And he was telling me how much this is such an incredible intervention that you can do to sort out someone's quality of life. You know, got arthritis in your hip or your knee, you're having a bit of a miserable time, and just this piece of bone carpentry sort them out. And I was pretty dazzled by the idea of it, how much it was possible to help people.
Yeah. What about things with your mum, Katie? Were you as close with her? Was it as easy with her?
So my mum was a theatre nurse, a scrub nurse, and she met Dad at work when she was very young. And my mum, I think I've inherited a lot of mum's wanderlust and ambition and you know, all of those kind of things that eat you up inside if you haven't got a way to realise them. And it was the mid-80s, so mum's available opportunities for what she could do with her career and her life were not anywhere near as amazing as the ones I've had. So she really had to give up her work quite early, as soon as she was, you know, pregnant pretty much. And she was a housewife for a long time. That was something that she was, I think, slightly miserable doing, because it was kind of foisted upon her, as it was for most a lot of people in that era, you know. She just never really had the opportunity to realise those dreams. I think I lived out a lot of them for her in a way.
Do you think also, you know, looking back for you as a little girl, was there a part of you that had this sense you had to make things better for your mum somehow?
Yeah. I think growing up in a household where I could see the vast difference in what it meant to have opportunities and what it meant to not, just by virtue of the circumstances and your gender or your age or whatever, that I think it drove into me some kind of inability to tolerate inequality and how it affects people. And I was like, that was very deep. It was like a splinter in somewhere really far down that I think a lot of my adult life, the work that I tried to do was about trying to get to that splinter and go, what is that thing that just drives me nuts? I can't find it. Where is it? And yeah, so there was a lot of digging.
As a kid, how did that urge to help and make better and remove injustice, how did that play out in terms of animals?
Well, I would, as a young kid, I still actually have this problem. I still can't handle it if I see a spider that's stuck indoors or, you know, a bug that's stuck against a window and is trying to get outside. And I'm like, oh, I will drop everything to grab it and take it, you know, put it back where it's meant to be. And I once found a cat having to go at a nest in a hedgerow, a shrew or mouse nest thing. And I don't know where the parents were, but there was all these little pink bald babies that were in there. And I chased this cat off, put all these mouse babies in my pocket. Went home. I was like, Mum, look what I've got. Poor Mum had a heart attack. And then I tried very hard to feed these poor little things warm milk with a pipette and I drowned them all, sadly.
Oh, no.
Which was a bit of a quite disturbing experience. Yeah.
And is it true, Katie, that you were even too empathetic to enjoy nursery rhymes?
So we had this really creepy, sinister video. It's so creepy, and it's like these kind of puppets playing out nursery rhymes, and there's a Humpty Dumpty and he has to climb up on the wall, and I would watch it going, oh no, don't do it, Humpty, go, no, and he'd fall off, break his poor little egg head open, and then all these king's horses and king's men would come and they'd be like, sorry mate, I can't really help you here, and that was the end of the story, and I would be bawling my eyes out. Mum said, now she used to come and find me sitting there sobbing, and what's the matter? Like, oh, Humpty Dumpty's fallen off.
So given the family background, Katie, was medical school always where you were going to head?
Yeah, 100%. I never really had any plans to do anything other than that. There was a brief moment when I thought maybe I should do veterinary medicine instead. But I think I rethought that and thought, actually, I don't think I'd be able to handle that. That would be even more...
It's easier to watch humans suffer than animals.
I mean, it's a pretty horrible choice that I'd set myself up for. But yeah, that was the ultimate decision. And I was, I was so excited. I was really impatient. And I started studying to be a doctor when I was, I think I'd only been 18 years old for 3 months.
So you went off to study in Wales. And your mum and dad actually separated while you were away at uni. Was that a surprise?
It was. It was a complete surprise. But looking back, it shouldn't have been. I think my mum had been really hanging in there, just waiting for her kids to be able to fly the nest. And it was a big shock. I'd actually known my mum was not well for a while, and I didn't know why or in what way. Yeah, and I remember my dad sitting me down and saying, look, your mother's really sick. And I thought, oh, my God, she's got cancer, because she kind of looked like she did. She lost a lot of weight. And I thought, oh, my God, she's got something really... And he said, she's got depression. And I was like, oh, God for that. but that's actually, I think, a comparably horrible thing to be going through. And for Mum, it was the weight of all of these unrealised things that she had, studying while something like that is happening in the background, it's quite difficult to juggle things.
Where was your first appointment as a doctor after graduating?
So I studied in Cardiff, which is in South Wales. My first job was in Bristol, which is just over the channel. Anyone that's been there knows it's a really, really fun city, really cool place to live.
And what about work in the hospital, though? I mean, did that feel like a natural fit for you right away?
It was really scary, really, really scary. My first shift as a doctor was a night on call, the first of an entire week of nights on call. I was on the ward cover for 300 odd beds. It was really, in the NHS back then, they really chuck you in at the deep end and you sink or swim. And yeah, it was quite a scary baptism of fire.
After a few years as a junior doctor, you took off travelling, that wanderlust that you mentioned, and ended up in Australia. Where was your first hospital job once you landed here?
It was in Tweed Hospital. Actually, when I was a student at university, I was backpacking quite a bit because I didn't really want to go home in the summer holiday. And I went driving along the east coast of Australia in a van with some mates. And I remember stopping in Byron Bay. This would have been 2005 or 6 or something, and thinking, God, this is pretty nice. I could live here. I had this pipe dream that one day I would, once I'd finished my studies and if I had the capacity to do it, I'd love to go and live in Byron Bay. And after a couple of years working in the NHS, I was pretty over it. It was not a fun couple of years. And I thought, what about that pipe dream that I had? And I went on, looked at a map and thought, which hospitals are nearby to Byron Bay? Where could I commute to? And I just harassed I emailed the hospitals and just pestered for, can I have a job? Can I have a job? And I got given one at Tweed.
So did life in Byron Bay live up to that pipe dream? Was it how you'd imagined it would be as a young backpacker?
It was pretty good. It was pretty nice. It was a big change from the slog of the UK. I remember there was one week in my first year of working that I counted up the hours that I'd done, and it was over 100 hours I'd worked in one week. I was an absolute mess. And in Australia, you worked 40 hours a week, 40-something, and you were paid for all of them, whereas you weren't in the UK. And then when you're not at work, you've got a lovely beach, and you surf, and you swim, and you explore the mountains, and it was just it was a magical place to be, and I really had a beautiful few years there.
Something called you, though, to do a different kind of work in Australia. You did some regional and remote work. Mm. What was that about? Why did you want to do that?
So I took up a job as a locum emergency doctor, and there's a massive, massive number of places in regional, rural, faraway Australia that rely on locum doctors to staff the hospitals because it's just very hard. You don't get enough people living in the places that need emergency staff. As a locum, it was a ticket to travel far and wide and loads of different places that were really remote.
Did it almost feel like you were in a different country than the one you'd been living in?
Yeah, it was a complete... I mean, I'd been in this bubble, this very, very...
A chai bubble, a chai linen bubble.
Yeah, and it was great. I loved it. But when I popped the bubble and went and travelled around, I was like, oh my God, oh dear, this isn't okay. There's a huge, huge discrepancy between the health of the average Australian that lives in some places against others. And I couldn't really get my head around how that was possible in somewhere that has this much wealth, you know, and has this much resources. It just seemed wrong to me that was the way that we'd spread things out. There was that little splinter that I still had.
So what decision did you make about where you were going to use your skills then?
Well, I'd had the dream to work for MSF the whole time that I'd been a student. I thought, I can see that this organisation does incredible work and I wanted to be part of it. But I also knew that it's quite hard to get into that. They don't just sort of... They're quite strict about who's able to work for them. And
for people who aren't familiar with MSF, Katie, what's the mission of Doctors Without Borders?
So Médecins Sans Frontières is their French name. It was originally set up in France, but it's now a global organisation that provides medical care where it's needed. It's neutral, it's impartial, it's purely based on who needs it the most. That was so aligned with what I was feeling, you know, when I was travelling around Australia. And it's a organisation that's incredibly scrupulous, probably the right word, I think, about where their money comes from. It only comes from individual donors. It doesn't come from governments. It doesn't come from industry. That no strings attached to any of the money pots that could influence their impartiality. So because of that, they have the capacity to work anywhere.
So, Katie, after you were accepted by MSF, or Doctors Without Borders, you were eventually sent to the Central African Republic. How much did you know about the Central African Republic?
Well, I don't know that I'd heard anything about that country before. But when I looked it up, I was like, actually, wow, it's been in a state of quite full-on conflict for several years. There's a population that are displaced on the scale of awful things that can happen to people. This is probably one of the worst places that you could live, you know, in terms of infant mortality, maternal mortality. Have you got enough food to eat? Do you have secure housing? The proportion of kids that finish school enough to have, or do enough school to be, have basic literacy is tiny. Everyone's sort of surviving on not much. And yet it's one of the places in the world that we extract a lot from. Diamonds, one of the big ones, huge diamond mining parts of the world, and gold and other resources. It's just next door to the Congo. It's slightly to the north of the Democratic Republic of Congo. And people are more aware of what's going on there. You just don't hear anything about the Central African Republic.
So this is where you were going to be sent. What kind of training did you get from MSF before you landed there?
They give you lots of paperwork to read. It was in French, so it had a bit.
You speak French?
Well, I thought I could speak un peu. Thought my French was all right, and then I got there and oh dear. So I was in Paris for a week, and there was a training week there, and it was, you know, like a crash course of how do you sandbag a building to protect from bullets? What do you do with chlorine if there's a cholera outbreak? How do you have buckets to stand in at the doorway of the hospital, that kind of stuff?
And then in February 2017, you were off to Bria, a city in the Central African Republic. What does that part of the world look like from the air, Katie, as you were flying in?
So Africa is huge. It's so huge. And the way that we have our spherical globe map put onto flat paper really shrinks Africa down. So proportionally, the size that we think Africa is when we look at a flat map, it's like blow that up massively and then shrink Greenland, Russia, China, shrink them down, and Australia, and then just blow Africa up massively. And then so Bria was in the very, very centre of that continent. So it was a long way from, you know, any coast. And there's this huge, huge, incredible rainforest in the Congo Basin, massive river. And slightly to the north of that in the Central African Republic, we've got lots of rivers, lots of water. It gets huge amounts of rainfall, which means huge amounts of malaria. And there's also a very strange thing about the Central African Republic. It's got one of the world's largest magnetic anomalies in it, which is a place where there's so much iron and magnetic minerals in the Earth's crust that compasses don't work.
It's massive. Really?
Yeah, huge, huge. Like, if you look at a map of the magnetic kind of polarity of the world, there's a giant, big red blob right where I was. And one theory about why, I mean, no one exactly knows what caused it, but one theory is a huge meteor just smashed into that part of the world many, many billions of years ago.
And what project were you meant to be involved in when you arrived? What was the plan?
The idea was I was going to be working in this paediatric hospital. We were going to anticipate having a massive amount of kids with malaria, most of them under 5 years old, like little toddlers that get malaria, as everyone does that lives there, and who, because they're so little, it's quite a, you know, risky thing to have, and a lot of kids die from it.
And what happened or was happening politically to change the focus of your work?
Well, we still had the malaria spike. We still had to do that. But there has been a civil war in Central African Republic since 2013. I was there in 2017. And this fighting had been flaring and been sort of raging on for a long time. There was a little bit of a lull happening at the time that I was flown out there. But very quickly, it kicked off. And Bria became a hotspot because it's a massive diamond mining center. It's a very rural town in the middle of very vast, kind of unpopulated, forested land, but it sits on this kind of strategically important bit of land where there's lots of different rivers and big travelling routes and a lot of different people, a lot of different groups that want to have control of that town.
So this is the situation you land in. What was the form, Katie, that you were asked to sign on your first day in Bria?
Do you mean the proof of life?
Yeah, that one.
Oh, God. I'll preface this before I say it with, this is not a normal MSF job, and I don't want to in any way paint working for MSF as like this ridiculously dangerous, awful, scary thing to do, because it's, I had a very, very unusually hectic job. Most of the work with them is nowhere near this dangerous or as difficult. And they look after their staff incredibly well. You know, I felt at all times like I was well supported and safe. However, they do have this form which you're supposed to copy out a paragraph in your own handwriting, and that they use that as a thing to have a sample of in case you get kidnapped and you're held hostage, and they need to be able to prove that you're actually, you, the person who is who they say they've got is who they say they've got. So that was, my handwriting was a bit wobbly. Oh my God.
So with that, you land in Bria. Where were you going to be living when you arrived there?
The town had 40,000 or so people living there. It had no paved roads. It had no electricity grid. It had no running water. It had no, like, zero infrastructure, pretty much. A lot of the houses were hand-built with grass roofs and red bricks made out of the earth. There were not very many cars. In fact, I don't think there were cars that didn't belong to either NGOs or the UN. It was really a place where there was very, very little money and resources other than diamonds, obviously. And so we would travel through the town, and the only buildings that you'd see that were sort of shiny and new looking and were the diamond trading compounds. So there would be these red brick huts and grass roofs and things like that. And then suddenly there'd be a building that had a big, nice wall that was freshly painted, and there would be big, shiny paintings of diamonds all over the outside of it, and then loads of razor wire across the top of it. So we had rented one of these compounds, one of these buildings, because it needed to be secure, it needed to be safe, it needed to have gates, it needed to have, and that was basically the only building fitting that description in the town. It wasn't one of the shiny ones. Ours was pretty knackered, and like, the paint was not sparkly like the other places. But yeah, we had our own troopies that were the ones that we'd be travelled around. We weren't allowed to walk anywhere. We weren't allowed to go out of the compound alone, or we weren't allowed to go out of the compound at all unless we were in the troopies being driven around.
And when you were first taken to see the hospital, how did it compare to what you were used to?
It didn't compare. I don't think there was any. It was a completely different thing. So we could have about 150 inpatients at a time if we really stacked them multiple to a bed. We had a main inpatient ward. We had a intensive care ward. So two big long tents, and then we had a little tiny emergency room. It was really just a small room, and we had a neonates sort of nursery, which was also a small room completely crammed with little cots that we would, these little tiny neonates in. And we had an outpatient clinic, so they would also see 100 or so, sometimes more, depending on what time of year it was, patients a day.
When you walk into an emergency ward in a hospital in Australia, it's full of machines, mm-hmm, and electricity and lights.
Yeah.
What was
beeping?
What were the resources there for you to work with as a doctor?
Well, the emergency room, and there was a lot of beeping in there. There would be plenty of noise, plenty of racket, but it was from this really low tech. We had, so the emergency room was a little tiny room. We had two rattly gurneys in there and a little desk, and it was super crammed. Everything was covered in red dust all the time. It was impossible to keep things clean. There was just this red dust that was stuck to everything always. And we had an oxygen concentrator. So obviously there wasn't running water, there wasn't electricity. We had two generators that ran, and we'd have to really hope that they didn't both break down at the same time. And these oxygen concentrators, which sort of look like a big suitcase, and you turn it on and it makes a massive racket and it blows a little stream of oxygen, you hope, out of the little port. And we would stick a pipe on there and then run that to the kid that needs the oxygen. And if more than one kid needs the oxygen, you've got to stick a little Y connector on the pipe and then split it. And it was so, so basic.
So nothing like x-rays or defibrillators or anything like that?
No, we didn't have any radiology whatsoever. We didn't have a lab. We had one operating theatre.
What advice did the doctor handing over to you give you about how to work in those kind of conditions, so different from what you'd been trained in and were used to?
I had one day of handover, which is quite frightening. I thought I was going to get a bit longer than that. They did say you'll probably get 2 weeks. I was like, okay, well, I could probably just about get the hang of it in 2 weeks. But things always change in this kind of work, and it wasn't 2 weeks; it was one day. And she told me, you've just got to do what you can do. You can only do very simple things. You can give fluid, you can give blood, you can give antibiotics, you can give antimalarials. And weirdly, in a way, even though the kind of work that we were doing was so much more stressful because it was so much, like the sort of conditions you see were just unimaginably far from what you'd normally see in a shift in an emergency department. Like it was pretty normal to go home at the end of a day and to be able to say, I saved 10 lives today. You never get to do that in a normal day's work in many jobs, but it was that level of desperate need. For example, a kid would come in crashing sort of septic shock or hypovolemic shock just from a bit of diarrhea for a couple of days. If you're already malnourished, if you've got malaria and then your drinking water's not clean and you get diarrhea for 24 hours, you're in trouble. You're in massive trouble. You can die very quickly from that. But you also can be resuscitated with just a bit of fluid. So it was amazing how much there was that we could do. And it was, in a lot of ways, all of those decisions and options that you don't have, not having them there, kind of made the work a bit, weirdly, a bit less stressful.
On that first day, did that doctor tell you to expect death?
Yes, she did. I already had sort of readied myself for that. But one of the scary things that she talked me through was the mass casualty plan. Here's what your normal job is, but what are you going to do if you suddenly get 20 people at once with gunshot wounds all coming in at the same time? And we had a bit of a plan for that. I didn't anticipate having to use it, which was not very not great foresight for me, because we did need to. Like within under a month, the first mass casualty incident happened. Mm.
Do you remember your first patient?
I actually do. Yeah, it was a little boy with a massive abscess, a huge, huge abscess on his foot. It's a place where any little cut is going to get really infected. And if you're already immunocompromised, which a lot of people are, if they've got HIV or if they've got TB or if they're not well nourished, these things can get really nasty really quickly. And he had this huge abscess on his foot and he was really sick. And I called the surgeon and said, I think this guy needs to go to theatre. And I was amazed that it took about 10 minutes before he was in theatre. Me saying that, I think he needs to go to theatre. Okay, cool, let's go. Bam, done. Everything was a lot simpler.
How long did it take till you experienced a death from a patient?
It was the first day. The very first day. And actually, I think it was pretty normal routine part of most days. A little boy who was only a couple of months old. I mean, the top things that we saw, malnutrition, malaria, TB, HIV, if you had all four of those, your chances were very, very, very slim. And this boy was also, he was so young, like he was tiny. He may have been born prematurely. Nobody knew. People don't count their pregnancies on a calendar, so we don't know how many weeks he was born at, but he certainly appeared like he might have been a premature baby, which, you know, also doesn't give you a great start. And he passed away that first day. And I hadn't seen that kind of thing before. You know, pediatric resuscitation is a pretty unusual thing to deal with in most hospitals, most emergency departments. So I had to get used to it pretty quickly.
Who was Pierre who took you under his wing? Tell me about him.
He was our surgeon. He was a hugely inspiring guy. He'd been working for MSF for 20-something years. He was a surgeon who could do anything. He was a guy that would just thrive in chaos and, you know, he would be incredibly bored if nothing was happening. He'd sit at home and be like, this is rubbish. Oh, come on, like I need to go somewhere else. This isn't exciting enough. When it kicked off, he was the guy that you wanted to have around. I mean, when I talked about that little boy that was in theatre in 10 minutes, that was because of him, you know. I said that he needs to go to theatre. Okay, let's go. Off we go. He would have been a person who saved more lives possibly than anyone there.
How did he help you with your French as well?
He didn't like me very much for probably first, I don't know how long it was, but he had very little patience with how bad my French was. And he just, my French was pretty bad. And eventually he sort of said, right, I'm going to teach you how to speak French properly. And he taught me how to swear. He said, you need to be able to swear properly here. You can't just... And he was right. I really did need to be able to swear properly.
Why? Why was that so important?
Because there's a lot to swear about. There's a lot of things that you really need to properly let rip like a pirate about. And it didn't really have the same, didn't hit right in English because no one knew what I was saying. Even though I did, yeah, I needed to be able to communicate that stuff, I think.
You were focused on the health and safety of your patients, but were there times when you were scared for your own safety in that environment?
Yes and no. I mean, probably the most scared I was the entire time was the first night when I went to bed and I heard gunfire go off. And I suddenly thought, oh my goodness me, I don't know what that gunfire means, but it doesn't sound good. And I thought, okay, is the compound about to get stormed? You know, what's happening? I had no frame of reference of what to do with that noise. And I suddenly thought, I'm so far from everywhere. I'm so far from home. I'm so far from safety. And I don't have any way to get myself out of here. And actually the next thing I heard was someone snoring. And I thought, oh, maybe it's not that scary a thing. And somebody else, you know, in the house was having a nice sleep through all this. And eventually I did learn that gunfire like that was not a very weird noise to hear.
There was a mass violence event, a security lockdown, I think, in the 8th week that you were there. How did that play out inside the compound with your colleagues?
Well, the city got stormed by one of the militia groups, and there was shooting and there was guys driving around on motorbikes, and we were under lockdown in those situations, so we would basically all hole up at the compound and shut the gates and just wait for it all to blow over. And hearing that sort of level of gunfire from all angles around your house, on the other side of the wall, I was obviously a little bit stressed about that. Everyone else in the house was like, cool, we've got a free afternoon off work. Let's put the football on.
What
else is there to do? You know, and actually it was several days of being stuck like that. So what else are you going to do? You just got to get on with it. The fighting would die down at sundown, really, because, you know, it's too dark to carry on. And then that would be when our working day would start. We'd jump in the vehicles and go over to the hospital, and there'd just be this carnage there. And we'd work all night.
The violence just kept getting worse during your time in Bria. What did that mean for you and the other MSF staff?
Towards the end of my time there was a huge massacre that forced most of the town to be displaced into a camp. And during that incident, most of our staff were local. They continued to show up to work and they treated everybody that was in the hospital the same. They a lot of them had horrendous things happen to them, to their neighbours, their families, and yet there was this fundamental baseline of every human life has inherent value. Whatever the allegiances, whatever's happened, whatever's been done, that's not the bottom line. The bottom line is we belong to each other, we care for each other, we're here to do what we can to make sure that our fellow human beings are not suffering. And obviously the violence that was going on outside was being driven by people that do not understand that. It was about diamonds, it was about, you know, it was about resources. But even so, with all of that happening, the knowledge that and the genuine sort of indisputable fact that human life has value, everyone's human life has inherent preciousness. I've never seen generosity like that. I've never seen humility like that. Or, you know, that we're kind of led to believe that we're selfish creatures, that we have this tribalism, we're us and them, we like to be polarized. And I don't think that's actually the case. I think at the very end of the day, in the worst circumstances, what prevails, what's much more common than hate, is connection and empathy and compassion.
It's so interesting that you're reflecting on that, given the circumstances you were in, because I would imagine as a doctor, it would be one thing treating terrible injuries or suffering after, say, a natural disaster, but you were treating carnage because of human violence.
Mm. Yeah, I think one of the things that was really, it's obviously quite difficult to make sense of that, but the human violence that's happening is as a result of people having lost touch with that connection to each other. And the people that would perpetrate that violence had gone through horrendous things themselves. You know, the Central African Republic has one of the highest rates of child soldier recruitment on earth. And the way that you get a kid who's been recruited into a militia to do those kind of things is it's unspeakable what has to be done to a person to get them to be able to do that stuff. And it's all about, like, cutting off humanity, cutting off the ability to see the human being that's in front of you. And so it was really, yeah, massively encouraging for me. It was something that was so important for me to see, that almost like a equal and opposite reaction, almost like you have this mindless hate and destruction, and then you, on the other side of it, you have this overwhelming generosity of spirit of people who have lost everything, who would still turn up to work and do what they can.
The situation that you're describing is so extreme and overwhelming. When did you realise that personally for you, you'd reached the limit of what you could do and where you could be of help?
Yeah, towards the end of it, I was starting to lose the plot a bit.
What did that look like for you? What did that mean?
I was aware that I was having to, like, increasingly I was having to struggle, like, really fight to keep my emotions under control, keep them at bay, stop, you know, I couldn't just fall apart at work. I couldn't see something that was really sad and then have the normal emotional response to that in the moment, because if I started to do that, then I wouldn't be able to work. But it became more and more like I couldn't keep it up forever. And there was a particular moment when I just completely broke down in the middle of the ward round and had to just bail and go back to the compound for a hyperventilation session in the shower. And at the time I hadn't been sleeping at all, because there was this nest of kittens that had taken up residence in the sandbags against my window, and they would meow really constantly all night. And I also had this worm, this parasite thing that had got into my foot, and it was chewing and chomping. It's the itchiest thing that's ever itched in the history of itching, and it was, that thing was, and I just was like, oh, I'm done. I've got to get out of here. So I asked, I was like, I need to go home. I'm cactus. And thankfully, that's all you need to say. You can just leave. But then I had to deal with the guilt of, why am I, how come I just get to leave? I just get to hit the eject button. What does that mean? You know? And I was consumed with guilt about that. And actually the final parting kind of wisdom that I was given there for people that didn't have the eject button anywhere within reach, the people that live there, people that have got you know, families and lives, and that's their home. They said to me, why are you being so self-indulgent with this guilt? Not in so many words, but they were like, you speak English, you have a voice, you can talk about what's happened here and people will listen to you. You can write a book, you can get a radio station to listen to you tell this story. We do not have that luxury, and we would love it, because part of what's happening here is the world is ignoring this part of this conflict. No one's interested, it's not on the news, nothing gets talked about here. Rather than wasting all your energy feeling so sorry for yourself, why don't you do something better, you know, a bit more useful? I was like, that's a good point, thanks, I'll bear that in mind. So I was asked to speak about the situation there. A lot of people said to me, please tell this story when you get home.
When you got home, though, what sort of state were you in?
A pretty strange one. I don't think I really knew how to pick up life again.
Did you feel like you could talk about what you'd been through with people, friends or psychologists or anyone?
I didn't, no. I mean, so MSF does recommend a review with a psychologist when you leave certain places. And so in Paris, I was told, you go and talk to the psychologist. You have to do that. And so I sat down with this young woman. She was in her 20s, and she looked so rattled just from probably having to do that job. And I thought, I can't dump anything on this poor girl. Like, and then I went back to Australia, and MSF would say, you know, we will pay for some sessions with a psychologist for you from here on. That's what's one of the standard things that's offered for people that have been through really traumatic work. And I thought, I am all right. Why do I need a psychologist for? I'm fine. We're still in that state of self-awareness. But I did start seeing a psychologist, and I realised that I wasn't particularly fine. But thinking that I was fine was part of the coping mechanism. But being in this world that suddenly made no sense at all was a really strange, alienating experience. And I couldn't talk to anyone about what I'd experienced, because it would be like trying to explain what a tree is to a fish. You know, like how do you verbalize that, and why would you bother trying? Because it's not gonna land.
How did that start to change? How did you get your way back from that place?
Writing was the way. I mean, it was a translation problem. People can understand things that they can hold in their mind and their heart, and I knew that one of the things that was so disturbing about that work was how much it was off the radar of the rest of the planet, and how unfair that felt. So I thought, okay, well, I can painstakingly translate this in a way that makes sense. And I knew that the way to do that was human stories. Like anyone with half a heart can read a story and feel, and the things that you feel emotionally land and they stay with you. The statistics that you read, they fall out your brain straight away. Well, they do for me anyway. Like, if you read, this is the, you know, mortality rate, this is how many people have been displaced in this conflict, I'll look at that number and go, gosh, that sounds awful. But then does it, do you feel anything when you read it? Or do you think, oh, I don't know what to do with that information? So having been there and felt these human stories, I thought, all right, here's what I have to do with this. I need to make them accessible to people that don't know, like I didn't, what this part of the world is like.
What would you say now to other doctors who, you know, like you, feel compelled to put their training to use in these terrible situations, you know, where it's so desperately needed, but where the personal toll is like what you've experienced?
What would I say to them? I think if you feel called to do that stuff, there's nothing anyone can really say to you to talk you into it or out of it. like I don't know what anyone could have said to me when I wanted to do that work that would have put me off. And I don't know how anyone could have talked me into it if I didn't want to. So I think it's an individual thing. If you're driven, if you're passionate about that stuff, then...
You don't think for the kind of kid who's weeping over Humpty Dumpty that this maybe isn't the right environment?
I think it's the perfect environment, you know, because you have to... it's the perfect environment for someone who wants to be able to bridge gaps that exist that are huge and unbridgeable otherwise. You need to be able to make those connections. I think that was one of the things I wanted to do, was to throw some kind of communication line of compassion, of understanding, of sameness. You know, like, I think one of the reasons it's so hard to relate to stories that exist in parts of the world you don't know anything about is that you can't imagine, you know, I don't know some of the life's like, I don't know what it's like to be there, what's the language, what's the history, yeah, da, da, da. But we have amazing imaginations as humans. We storytellers, that's why, that's how we've established the giant civilizations that we've made, is through stories. And I know that you need to be able to empathize, to tell stories, to hear them and to tell them, which one of the amazing things about the work you do is that, you know, being able to feel the story that someone's got and hold it. Mm. And that was what was so hard for me when I came back from that job, was I don't know who's going to be able to hold this. So writing was the way to pass it on.
Tell me about the kind of work you ended up doing back in Australia, in Melbourne, connected with Monash University.
I tried to carry on doing emergency medicine for a few more years after I got back, but I increasingly wasn't really able to tolerate the noise and the pace of it. And I thought, I don't know if this is really the career for me. And I was getting more interested in mental health and specifically, trauma. How does that impact people? So I decided that I would retrain in psychiatry. And in the last couple of years, not many people know about Australia and the huge thing that's happened recently with Australia becoming the first country on earth to legalize certain psychedelic medicines as a treatment for PTSD and depression. So in Australia, it is now an option to have MDMA-assisted therapy as a treatment for PTSD. And I got a job with the team at Monash University as a therapist on one of their trials, focusing on first responders. And I think that I didn't have a huge amount of experience working as a therapist, but I had a lot of experience of knowing what it was like to be the carrier of something too horrendous to speak to anyone about, and how isolating that is, and how much that drives the condition of PTSD, and what the ability to connect with other people and to sort of feel less alone, to be able to share that stuff, how that is the way out of it.
How is it that MDMA can help people who have been up close to terrible things and are suffering PTSD as a result? What is the benefit of that drug that you've seen?
It's an interesting substance, because it, while acutely under the influence of it, it has a effect on fear, and it reduces the amount of sort of panic and sort of amygdala limbic system overload that kicks off. And in people that have PTSD, that's one of the big barriers to being able to metabolize and integrate the things that have happened to you that you've seen, because, you know, you just get so activated and so overwhelmed, even going anywhere near it, that it becomes too much, too difficult. I mean, with a lot of therapy and a really trusting relationship with your therapist, it is possible, but most people that have that condition don't have the money, the time, they don't have the access to being able to do years and years of therapy. And MDMA is not the treatment, it's just an adjunct to facilitate the treatment, which is psychotherapy. But it makes the process, in specific moments throughout the treatment course, it helps you to forge trust and a sense of connection. And that's one of the things that's so difficult and so alienating in that situation. So it's not for everyone. You've got to really carefully select who it's going to be useful for. You know, I was fortunate enough that I could put myself through lots of therapy after that experience to get myself back to a state where I can work again and function and participate in life. But when you're in that situation, you just can't imagine that anyone else could possibly ever feel the same way. And so there was a period where I did feel super alone. When I came back, I went, right, I'm done with humans. I'm out. I'm going to get a dog and I'm going to move to the woods. and that's that. I'm going to just avoid speaking to people. And I think that was a necessary sort of thing to do for a while. But more and more now, I'm aware that that's a temporary sort of breather that is, you can't live like that for long. And so I think in the work that I'm very passionate about now, it's about sort of helping people to recognise that they are not forever stuck in isolation.
So that urge that you've had from a very little girl to help, that splinter, you know, to make everything better, is that still there in you, and how do you hold it now?
It is. It's matured, perhaps, in a way. I think I was. The savior complex is an interesting one, isn't it? Like I had this. It's not necessarily about saving the world in most cases. It's about working out why do you have this giant problem with the polarities that exist in the world. And I think I recognize now that it can be self-defeating if you don't understand what your motivations are actually all about. It's not about helping people or being the one that comes in to do the rescuing. It's about standing beside people as they are able to do that for themselves. And a huge part of it is about bearing witness. And one of the big missions that MSF has, it's obviously about delivering healthcare and delivering medicine, but it's also about bearing witness. And they are often a group that gets to see things that no one else on earth gets to see. Even the most intrepid reporters would not go to some of the places that MSF works. And if you're somebody who has the enormous privilege and responsibility of parachuting into somewhere like that from somewhere like Byron Bay, then bearing witness is a big part of your job. And coming back and being able to continue to do that is just as important. For me, it felt like it was just as important a part of the work as what I did.
Katie, it's really been amazing to meet you and hear about your experiences. Thank you so much for being my guest on Conversations.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Katie Treble was my guest on Conversations today, and Katie's book is Field Notes from Death's Door. This conversation was produced by Maggie Morris and recorded on the lands of the Turrbal and Yagara peoples. Our executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.